Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Good evening and a big welcome to everybody here tonight to listen to Andrew Solomon. My name's Rosie Boycott. I'm a director of Hay here in Colombia, and I've been involved in Hay for years. And Andrew is, in fact, a very old friend of mine who I've known for 25 years, I think now, from when Andrew was a young journalist. And we
both, as was Rosie.
As was Rosie. Thank you. We both worked on the same magazine, so I've followed his amazing career. And his new book, which has been out in Spanish for now about 6 months, Far From the Tree, is an extraordinary work. I hope and think probably some of you have read it or know about it, but it is a book about difference in our society and how we learn to love. And actually what you come away from that book, I think, is just the power of love to overcome all sorts of complicated and difficult things. So I want to start really, Andrew, to set the scene about this book. You yourself grew up, you had dyslexia, which was something that your mother could cope with, yes?
Yes. So when I was very little, I had shown a lot of interest in books. I loved being read aloud to. I loved the whole experience of books, but I had a lot of trouble at learning basic letters. I couldn't write. I had difficulties reading, and I was diagnosed with dyslexia. And my mother, who had been a teacher, worked with me endlessly on turning the dyslexia around, reading hour after hour after hour, making it all into a great game. So yes, there is the sense that we faced this thing down and we triumphed over it.
But when you later on in your life you came out as gay, this was much trickier.
I've sometimes said that because we had overcome one apparent neurological abnormality, the assumption was that we could readily overcome another apparent neurological abnormality. But that isn't quite the way that it worked. And part of the theme of Far From the Tree, and one of the central arguments in it, is that there are some forms of difference that can be changed and should be changed, and some forms of difference that cannot be changed or should not be changed, and that it can often be very hard to tell the difference. So the gay thing, I think there had been signs of it from early on. I sometimes tell the story that when I was six, I remember going to a shoe store with my mother and my brother. And at the end of getting our shoes fitted, we were each told that we could have a balloon to take home. And my brother wanted a red balloon, and I wanted a pink balloon. And my mother said that she thought I'd really rather have a blue balloon. And I said, no, I really wanted the pink one. And she reminded me that my favorite color was blue. The fact that my favorite color now is blue, but I'm still gay. We'll give you some evidence of a mother's influence and its limits.
But how did you come to write the book? I mean, there was a commission, yes, of a story.
There was.
Sorry,
I'm still working out this rocking chair
actually,
thing.
Actually, sit forward like...
Right. There we are.
You look incredibly uncomfortable.
Do I look all right now? About 20 years ago, my editors at the New York Times Magazine assigned me an article about deaf culture. And I was very taken aback at the time. I thought of deafness as entirely a disability. Those poor people, they couldn't hear. What could we do for them? And then I went out into the deaf world, and I went to deaf clubs, and I went to deaf theater, and I went into homes in which everyone was signing, and I even went to the Miss Deaf America contest in Nashville, Tennessee, which I commend to any of you who are able to get there. And as I moved deeper and deeper into this world, I realized that deafness really is a culture. It's a culture unified around the shared use of sign language. And then I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, that those hearing parents, by and large, pressure their children to function in the hearing world, and that those children often find deaf culture in adolescence or thereafter when it comes as a great revelation to them. And I thought how similar that was to the experience of gay children, who are mostly born to straight parents, who often would like their children to function in what they see as the mainstream world, and who often discover gay culture in adolescence or thereafter when it comes as a glorious revelation. And then a friend of a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf. And it turns out that most dwarfs are born to parents of average height. And suddenly Lisa was saying, do I tell her she's just like everyone else, only short? Or do I have to help her construct some kind of dwarf identity? Do I have to go out into the world and make her have a sense of what it means to be a dwarf? And as she narrated that bewilderment, I thought, there it is again. There it is again, a family that perceives itself to be normal with a child who is in some striking way exceptional. And I thought, this is a pattern, and that became the topic of my book.
And how did you contact people? I mean, did you plan at the beginning to produce a book that was 800 pages that looked at this enormous range of, first of all, things like deafness that you're born with, and then, you take it right through, and we'll talk about this in a minute, to children who do murder people or become different. How was your progress through it? Because you spent 10 years of your life, didn't you?
I did spend 10 long years on it, and I ended up with a wide variety of topics. People have sometimes said, was it difficult to come up with the list? And what was difficult was to narrow down the list, because once I came up with this idea that I was looking at what I called horizontal identities, these identities that are not inherited generationally, but that people have that are different from their parents, there were so many of them that I didn't know what to do with it. And I had a list at one point of over 100 things. And people would hear what I was doing and they would say to me, but are you thinking about writing about Marfan syndrome? You must write about Marfan syndrome. And I would say, I've never even heard of Marfan syndrome. And they all sort of came along. In the end, I chose the topics I did because I wanted things that constellated and described the full range of experience. And the first half of the book is about what we've defined as medical conditions. It's deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, and multiple severe disabilities. And the second half is focused on things that are more socially described. So families of prodigies who are also quite overwhelmed, families of people who have been conceived in rape, families of people who commit crimes, and families of people who are transgender. And I wanted to look in all of these circumstances at what the relationship was between these three sort of threads of acceptance. How do the people affected by these conditions achieve self-acceptance? How do their families come to accept them? And how does the larger society come to accept the kids and their families? And I found that each of those feeds the other in very complicated ways.
So if we took those three categories and looked at one situation, whether it's deafness or dwarfism, if we took one of those, one of your categories and tried to, and went through the self, the family, the society, I mean, if, say, your parents and you give birth to a dwarf child, what's your reaction to start with as a parent? I imagine it, however much you love the child, you're also devastated.
Yes. I found that parents tended to go through from outrage and horror to bewilderment to acceptance, and in some cases, celebration. And it would be nice to say that that's a linear process and everyone gets from one to the other in some smooth and orderly way, but it isn't. Some people get stuck at one stage or another, and many people go back and forth. They finally come to celebrating their child for who their child is, with these differences, with these disabilities, and then the child situation gets worse, or the child gets to be older and the social dynamics become more difficult, or something else goes wrong, and they're right back at outrage all over again, and they have to keep making their way back and forth. It's a very gradual process through which those transformations are achieved. And some people have said, when I've talked about the book, well, what about all the people who don't make it through to acceptance and who don't make it through to celebration? And there are a lot of those people, and there are some of them in the book. But what was most interesting to me was how often parents really do manage to make this progress. And as I worked on the book, I became very aware of a distinction that I'd never understood before, and that was the distinction between love and acceptance. And I believe that even though we hear tales of terrible abuse, that most parents love their children. And I think love is something that should be there from the time a child is born. But acceptance is a process, and it takes time, and it always takes time. And a lot of these parents, when they find it difficult to accept their children, they themselves feel that they don't love those children. And a lot of these parents, when they don't accept their children, have children who feel unloved. And I think it's very important to tease those things apart and say, you can have love, it should strive toward acceptance, but that's a process.
So if you are a child born deaf and your parents spend all their energy trying to get you a cochlear implant or whatever you can do, in a way that's the parent saying, I do not accept who you are. I mean, at what point should you be trying to fix it?
Well,
or not fix it?
I wish that there were a kind of hard and fast rule. What I've seen is that we live in a time of enormous social progress in which acceptance of these differences is at a level never before imagined. And we also live in a time of medical progress in which our ability to address and to some extent rectify these differences is at an unparalleled level. And when you are a parent, you have two obligations, really. One of them is to change your child. You have to change your child. You educate your child, you give your child a sense of moral values, you try to teach your child some manners, mm-hmm. You do all of these things in an attempt to change your child. If you didn't, it would be neglect. And you also need to celebrate your child for who he is and make him feel or her feel terrific about him or herself. And some things clearly need to be changed, and some things clearly are unchangeable and need to be accepted, and a great deal falls in a foggy middle. So if a parent chooses a cochlear implant, which is a device medically implanted in the brain that allows sound information to bypass the structures of the ear and gives people who are born deaf some facsimile of hearing, if a parent makes that choice, that can be a valid choice, and the child may grow up with the sense that he really functions in the hearing world and is happy there. Or other children may grow up with the sense that they aren't quite of the hearing world and are not really quite of the deaf world. And what I came away with was the sense that as a parent, you need to leave your child the various opportunities as long as you can. So if my child had been born deaf, I probably would have chosen a cochlear implant because I'm a great believer in communication between parents and children. I'm not great at languages. It would be hard for me to gain the fluency in sign language that I have in speech. But I would have tried to bring that child up also with the sense that there is a deaf world, to have that child learn sign language. I would have tried to learn it side by side, and I would have wanted that child to feel always that he could be loved or accepted whichever way he chose to go in adulthood.
Have you got any idea how you yourself would have felt had your child been born deaf?
I would have felt very differently from the way that I felt after I had worked on this book.
Yeah.
The day after my son was born, in fact, the pediatrician came in and said to us that he was not extending his legs correctly. And I remember thinking that seemed a little odd. And I said, oh, and she said, that could reflect some form of brain damage, she said. And insofar as he's doing so asymmetrically, which could indicate a tumor in his brain. And by the way, he has a very large head and he should be tested for hydrocephalus. And I felt the whole center of my being sort of pouring out onto the floor. And I thought, here I've been writing this book about how much meaning people can find in the experience of having children with differences and disabilities, and I don't want to join their number, and I wanted to protect my child, and I wanted my child to be well, as parents time out of mind have wanted their children to be well. But having said all of that, I also recognized, even in those moments, that if he was in fact going to have any of the things that we were being threatened with, that that would become, to some degree, his identity. And if it became his identity, it would become my identity too, and ultimately an identity in which we all might find a lot of meaning. So did I want it? No, it was not what I wanted. It was not what I would have chosen. A lot of these things are not what anyone would have chosen, but I think I was prepared to go through that process of acceptance and celebration.
It's interesting, though, you say that you use the word what we would have chosen. I mean, I have a friend in London, and he has a daughter who has Down syndrome, and he and his wife knew that they were going to give birth to a Down syndrome baby from the amniocentesis when she was 18 weeks pregnant, and they're Catholic, but and they chose to have her, and she's much loved, and she's a wonderful now young woman, and they fight very hard to say if you know the advances in science which could have got rid of her quite legally, and everyone would have been sympathetic, that we will, you know, we want to do away with actually the complexity and wonderfulness of the world.
There's a family with whom I spent quite a lot of time, Tom and Karen Robards, who have a son with Down syndrome. And I remember asking them this question. They were very surprised when their son was born with this condition. They were very young.
They didn't have amnio.
They didn't have amnio, no. Though I think that if they had had amnio, they would have kept the pregnancy nonetheless. They're also strongly Catholic. And they ended up becoming activists to change the way that children with Down syndrome are educated and are among those who are responsible for the extraordinary change in the lives of people with Down syndrome. People with Down syndrome now live twice as long as they did 50 years ago. Some of them are writers or artists. Some of them are able to live semi-independently. The progress has been amazing. And I said, do you wish that you'd never heard of Down syndrome? Do you wish you hadn't had to deal with this all these years? It's been so central to your life. And Tom Robards, the father, said, well, for our son David, I wish I could make it go away, because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world, and I would like to give him an easier life. But I think if we lost everyone with Down syndrome from the world, we would live in an impoverished society. It's part of human diversity, and if we lost it, it would be tragic. And Karen Robards, David's mother, said, well, I'm with Tom. If I could fix it for David, I would for David to give him an easier life. She said, but speaking for myself, while I would never have believed 30 years ago when he was born that I could come to such a point, speaking for myself, I have. For David, I would fix it in an instance, but I wouldn't give up the experiences I've had for anything in the world. They've given me a richer, more purposeful, more meaningful life than I could ever have had otherwise. And I think that those statements are all true. I think they would try to help and cure their son and make his life easier. And I think they found enormous meaning in their experience and recognized the contribution to human diversity.
Something that seemed to be current through an awful lot of your stories was that the parents who really accepted what had happened, it then became such a big part of their life.
Yes. I think it frequently will take over your life. It becomes, in many ways, your defining identity. There's one mother who I got to be quite close to who has a daughter, her experience with whom led her to write what really are the most important modern books on dwarfism. I realize that's a very specific category, but they really are the best books on that front. And I said to Betty, you know, what do you think about this? It really seems, again, to have become so central to your life. And she said, well, she said, if someone had said to me when I was pregnant, Betty, how would you like to give birth to a lesbian dwarf? I would not have ticked that box. She said, but she's Anna, and she's the cornerstone of the family, and I'm sorry the road was so steep for her, but I'm glad that she climbed it with grace, and I'm glad of what it opened up to me. Friendships and lives I would never otherwise have had. These conditions require a lot of support, most of them. They require a lot of attention, and I think it's impossible to remain sort of just quietly disengaged. I think either you're kind of pushing it away and trying not to be engaged with it at all, or you allow it to come in, not to take over your life, but to take a very significant place in it.
And what about the people who do push it away, who can't cope or can't something? Can't love, can't?
Well, can't love is sort of a dire description. I suppose there are some people who can't love, but I think that's a relatively small group of people. But I think that that different people have different capacities. And I think that while it has been oppressive for people with disabilities to be told that they are lesser disabilities or a variety of other differences. Remember, I've talked about prodigies, I've talked about gay people, I've talked about all kinds of situations. Being told that you're an inferior sort of human being is very oppressive. But telling parents, this is actually the most glorious experience and you're going to be incredibly lucky to have had it and you're going to end up celebrating it and denying the reality of their grief can be very poisonous. On the plane coming down, I read an essay that was sent to me by a woman who had read my book, and she said, I'm very sympathetic to these stories, but I wanted to share with you my story. And it was an essay that she had just published in a small literary journal, and it was about the grief that she felt when her biological daughter explained that he was transgender, that he was going to have surgery and live henceforth as a man. And she said, I love my son. I absolutely love him, and I accept that that's who he is. And I grieve for the daughter I had and for the life that I had imagined for her. And I think the honest thing is to admit that both things are true and that you're always struggling between them. And I think you have to recognize that different people have different capacities and that some people really can't deal with this. And if you really can't deal with it, give your child up for adoption, find someone else who can help you through it, do whatever it is that you need to do to protect the child. But don't torture yourself because you aren't actually finding this experience rewarding. Only be awake to the possibility that if you give it a little more time, you might shift in your point of view.
And do you find that, did you find that time really helped a lot of people?
Oh, time made an enormous difference, I found. I mean, I think over and over again of this whole process, the process of finding meaning, and I think of two statements which were both made to be by mothers. Fathers also say some great things, but these happen to be mothers, each of whom had two children with multiple very severe disabilities. And one of them had a son who was born with these terrible challenges. She was told it was a random fluke and that it wouldn't happen again. She had a second child who was fine, and then a third child who had exactly the same syndrome as the first, and neither of those children was ever able to walk or to talk. And the younger one ultimately died tragically through caregiver neglect. And the funeral took place, and the mother said, "Let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed, once of the child I wanted and once of the son I loved." Mm. And the other mother was someone who also had two children who had a condition that was very much shortened their lives. And she said, "You know, people always give us these little sayings like, God doesn't give you any more than you can handle." Yeah. But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen. And it was that process of choice, the way that people face that choice, that was really the topic I was investigating.
And what were the most, before I want to talk next about prodigies and the things that the world would think were wonderful, but were there any, were there any stories that stayed with you? You know, after you'd got to the end of the 10 years, are there any particular ones that just come back and haunt you as a father yourself now?
Well, there are lots of them that have stayed with me and that come back and haunt me. But I'll tell you the story of Clinton Brown, who was one of the dwarfs I got to know.
And it's a wonderful story.
When he was born, his parents were told that he had diastrophic dwarfism, that he would never learn to walk or talk or recognize them, and that they should leave him at the hospital to die quietly. But his mother said, "No, that's my baby, and I want to take him home, and I want to try." And so she took the baby home, and she managed, despite not having a lot of resources and despite it being sort of pre the era of the internet, to find the best doctor in the US for the treatment of people with dwarfism. And she took him to see Dr. Stanley Kopitz, and she described, she described arriving at Dr. Kopitz's office, and she said all these other doctors had said such dire things, and this was the first doctor who looked at the baby and said, "Let me tell you, that's going to be a handsome young man one day." And she said that in the course of his childhood, he had 30 major surgical procedures, as a result of which he now, in fact, can walk. And while he was having them, he was stuck for long periods of time in a hospital, and he thought as long as there was nothing much else to do there, he might as well focus on his schoolwork. And he achieved academically at a level previously unknown in his family and became the first member of his family to go to university. And one day, his mother called me, and she was at this university, he was living in a fraternity, he had a specially fitted car that he could drive there. He was not too far away from where his parents lived. And she said, "I was driving home from shopping today, and I went past a bar, and there was Clinton's car parked outside a bar." She said, and I thought to myself, he's 3 feet tall, they're 6 feet tall, two beers for them is four beers for him. She said, I wanted to go in there and interrupt, but I knew I couldn't do that. So I drove home, and I left him 11 messages on his cell phone. She said, and then I thought, if someone had told me when he was born that my future worry would be that he would go drinking and driving with his college buddies, I'd have been so thrilled to have that problem. And I said to her, what do you think you did? How do you think it came to be that someone for whom there were such terrible predictions ended up as a person who's successful and accomplished and popular and happy. I said, what did you do? And she said, what did we do? We loved him, that's all. Clinton just always had that light in him, and we were lucky enough to be the first to see it there.
Well, that's wonderful.
So, thank you.
Well, there are so many moving stories. I know it's a book you can go on reading all through your life, actually. But let's talk also, because it's very interesting, about the prodigies and how they unsettle everything and chuck things in the air. Why did you go for a prodigy? I mean, that's the kind of child that you think, oh, amazing, you know, they're going to go to Harvard at 10 and a half. And
I wanted to look at the idea that what I was really examining was not disease, but difference.
Yeah.
And most prodigies are born to parents of sort of reasonably normal intelligence. And while having a child who's different in that way is less sad than having a child who has very severe disabilities, it is not any easier. Because the questions that come up are in many ways the same questions. And in the same sense that it's quite difficult to deal with someone who has the body of a 30-year-old and the mind of a 2-year-old, it's very difficult to deal with someone who has the body of a 2-year-old and the mind of a 30-year-old. And when you have one of these children who are asynchronous, that's the term for being sort of out of sync in your developmental processes, the child is either spending time with adults who are not very interested in being friends with a 5-year-old, or with other 5-year-olds who don't understand a single thing he wants to talk about. And so there's a lot of loneliness attached to that. And trying to make sure a child like that doesn't grow up feeling like a freak, trying to make sure a child like that is able to exploit and enjoy whatever doors his abilities open, whatever opportunities they afford him, without somehow feeling as though he's under pressure to perform to a very high standard. You know, these tensions are very difficult to resolve. And so I had these parents who would describe to me having these bewildering children and feeling they didn't know what to do. And there's actually quite a lot of self-help literature for people who have got a child with, for example, Down syndrome. You join the Down Syndrome Society of America. There are a bunch of really terrific books out there. I've listed some of them in my bibliography. They explain the whole thing. You have a child who's a great genius, and people say, yeah, what do you have to complain about? Yep. And there's not much support for it, and it's very hard to figure out what to do. And there are many people who are born with extraordinary abilities who then go way off the rails as they get older. They feel that they somehow have set a standard they have to arrive at. And it's always important to remember that a prodigy is someone who can perform at an adult level as a small child. And it has to do with the speed with which one arrives at competence. It doesn't have to do with the depth of competence. And the fact that when you're 6, you can play the piano like a talented 25-year-old does not mean that when you're 25, you'll be one of the great pianists of our time. And for many of them, that's shattering. And how do you give them a sense that they have value outside of the condition of being a prodigy that they have? And so in many ways, it really felt very parallel to the other experiences I was writing about.
And what happens with a prodigy then? I mean, I'd never quite realized that it was just about that you can do something a 25-year-old can. It doesn't actually mean you do it well in the big scheme of the world. So they must be, as you say, they must be shattered. And presumably their parents have invested hopes that then bound back. Very complicated.
And the parental hopes can be very complicated. I had a fascinating set of interviews with the pianist Lang Lang and his father. He's, you know, probably the most famous classical musician of our time, and has a kind of rock star status in China, where his face is sort of plastered on the sides of buses selling toothpaste and things. And his father pushed him and pushed him and pushed him as a child. There's a story that he told about how he came home one day from school half an hour late. And his father said, if coming home to practice the piano does not matter to you more than this, your life has no value and you might as well end it. You can choose. The balcony is there to jump from. There are pills in the medicine cabinet you can take. Your life means nothing now. I mean, the pressure was unbelievable. And I said to Lang Lang, you know, do you feel like you were an abused child? Because it certainly sounds to me like child abuse. And he said, I think very wisely, he said, if my father had pressured me this way and I had not succeeded, it would be child abuse and I would be miserable. But since my father pushing me that way allowed me to become an international superstar, which I very much enjoy being, I will say that for me it was an excellent way to grow up.
Whoa, yeah, but that's a pretty fine line. I mean, let's think of all the... I mean, for some reason, I think immediately of tennis, and you have all these mad tennis mothers and tennis fathers, and a heck of a lot of them do not grow up to be Serena Williams and Andy Murray. So as a father now yourself, I mean, this whole thing of pushing a child like that, is that a form of child abuse?
Well, I do think it's a form of child abuse. I mean, I tell the Lang Lang story, you know, partly because I think it's indicative of the range of experience people have. Obviously, most people who are pressured do not become Lang Lang or Serena Williams or
they might fail.
Any of these things. They often fail. And I think the problem frequently is that they're made to feel that their value, their worth inheres in what they accomplish. And I think that's a very dangerous position. I think with children, you have to push them sometimes. I mean, we recently took our son for to learn to ski. And the first day he said, I'm no good at this and I hate it and I don't want to do it. And we had to say, if you keep it up for a few more days, you'll begin to get the hang of it and it might give you a lifetime of pleasure. And now he's sort of, when can we go skiing again? When can we go skiing? You know, he's all excited about it. You have to do a certain amount of that. And you have to not push someone to do things that they're actually incapable of doing or that they ultimately don't want to do. And again, it's one of the tasks of parenthood is how do you identify what is encouragement and what is pressure? And it's not always a clear line. But I would say if I were going to err, I would err on the side of holding back rather than on the side of pushing. Because while I've told that Lang Lang story, I also met any number of people who really seemed to me to be utterly destroyed by the experience of being pushed too hard and who felt that none of the rest of their life had ever measured up to the success they had when they were six. You know, even Josh Bell's mother, and Josh Bell is also a terribly famous musician, a violinist. Josh Bell's mother said to me, he played a concert when he was seven, and there were huge write-ups in all the papers. She said, and he played another concert when he was eight, and he was a much better violinist at eight. But it was less miraculous that an eight-year-old was able to play that well and the reviews weren't as good. She said, and then I felt I had to pull him out of the public eye, which she did for many, many years. She said, because I realized that otherwise he was going to become a better musician and get less attention for it, and it was going to destroy whatever ability he had. And I think there has to be a sense that you protect children. I mean, I think that's your primary obligation, really, as a parent, is to protect children.
And for parents who have children who... In the second half of your book, when you go into rape, crime, how you describe it, you know, things that happen not from the result of your birth, how does the parent deal with that?
A lot of the time, whether a society assigns a medical or an experiential basis to any condition has a huge effect on what the whole family's experience is. So for a long time, people said that autism was caused by cold and withholding mothers, refrigerator mothers. And parents of children with autism, therefore, were not only dealing with a child who faced very significant challenges, but also with an enormous sense of shame. And now we've largely stopped saying that about autism. And we've largely stopped blaming parents for a lot of the other things that are wrong with their children. So at birth or just thereafter. I mean, in the 18th century, it was said that deformity and dwarfism were manifestations of a mother's unexpressed lascivious longings, her sort of erotic, out of control fantasies. So we got over all of that. But we still tend to say that parents have somehow caused their children to be criminal or to be transgender or to have some of these other characteristics, and our doing so makes it much more difficult for those parents to acknowledge the ways in which their children are different and to acknowledge the love that they have for those children. And of course, if your child has committed crimes, you most likely regret the crimes terribly and wish you could do anything to make them go away. But is the appropriate response to that to abandon your child? Probably not. And where do you find a community of people who are not abandoning their children? Where do you get a sense of how you go about loving someone who's behaved in a way that you find atrocious? Where do you find those structures? They're very elusive. And when I published the book, I assumed I'd get lots of letters from people who would say, oh, my child has Down syndrome, and you know, it was great to read these stories. And I got quite a lot of those. But I get floods of letters from the parents of people who have committed crimes in particular, who say, nobody has ever understood what I'm going through. Nobody wants to hear these stories. And so I felt they were very important stories to tell.
So what do they, tell me some of the stories of the people who write to you about that, because is it that they carry the guilt for what they've done, the guilt for what they, how they brought them up?
I'll tell you the story of Sue Klebold, who was one of the people I interviewed for the book. Sue Klebold is the mother of Dylan Klebold, and Dylan Klebold was one of the perpetrators at the Columbine Massacre,
yeah,
which in 1999 was the worst school shooting in history and set the template for a lot of the school violence that has occurred in the last decade and a half. And the Klebolds had resisted having a conversation with me, and I spent years trying to persuade them to talk to me, and they finally agreed to it. And the first weekend I spent with them, when they'd finally agreed to talk, they were so full of their story that they couldn't stop telling it. And I remember on the third day that I was there, Sunday night, we were all sitting in the kitchen. Sue was making dinner. We were utterly exhausted. And I said, if Dylan were here now, what do you think you'd want to ask him? And his father said, I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing. And his mother looked at the floor, and she thought for a minute. And then she said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head. And when she and I had dinner a few years later and we're talking about that episode and what she said, you know, when it first happened, I used to wish I had never had children. I used to wish I hadn't gone to Ohio State. I hadn't met Tom. These children would have existed and this horrible thing wouldn't have happened. But over time, I've come to feel that I love the children I had so much that I don't want to imagine a life without them, even at the cost of this pain. When I say that, I'm speaking of my own pain, of course, not the pain of other people. But while I recognize that it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, I've decided that it would not have been better for me. And that's what people write to me about over and over again, is their horror at what their children have done, and the fact that once you have established the loving bond of being the parent to a child, the fact that that child somehow goes off the rails, somehow turns out to be broken, somehow damages the rest of the world, is not necessarily enough to undermine the basic fact of that love, and that the society at large doesn't accept that complexity and the ambivalence inscribed in it.
Gosh, did she, Sue, or any of them, did they ever get over the guilt? I mean, presumably you must feel a guilt as a parent. You must think, if I had, I don't know, told him not to eat sweets or told him to write his thank you letter, I mean, whatever it is.
Yes, I think there's enormous guilt, and I think there's a real despair that's attached to that guilt. There's always that feeling of sort of, you know, Sue Klebold said that after Columbine, she was once taking a quiz in a women's magazine, and it asked about various things that you should or shouldn't do with your children. She said, I went through the quiz, and it was all about how to bring up your adolescent, she said, and there were 20 questions, and I got 19 of them right. But the one I got wrong was the one that said, your child is keeping a secret diary and has it locked in a drawer. Do you break into the drawer to read it? She said, and the correct answer was, no, that would be intrusive. And after the experience I had, the answer was yes. If I had broken into Dylan's room, if I had found the journals that he had hidden, if I had looked under his bed, I would have found out that there was something going terribly wrong that he had managed so well to hide from me. And every one of these parents who I talked to felt this sense of, I should have been there, I should have known, if I had only known what I would have done, and they relive over and over and over again what's happened and their helplessness in the face of it.
Yeah, it's definitely a much, much tougher parental role of difference than any of the others, isn't it?
Oh, I think it's the most heartbreaking. I mean, there was heartbreak in many of the things
yes.
that I wrote about
Different
and in many
of
the things I looked
though,
at. But yes, there's, because you can ultimately end up saying, implausible though it may seem to people who haven't done it, you can say what Tom and Karen Robart said. You can say,
yeah,
I wouldn't have chosen a child who had Down syndrome, but the experience has been the richest and most meaningful experience of my life. And you can end up saying that about many of the things I wrote about. Even the things that are more socially constructed, like being transgender. I've had people who've said it stretched me in ways I never expected to be stretched. One woman who had been driven out of the town where she lived by religious fundamentalists who had said that her child was against the will of God and who were threatening to kill both her and her child, as well as her husband and their other children.
Was this this was in the States?
This was, yes, in the American South. But she said to me, if I hadn't had this transgender child, I would have lived my whole life in that community and not discovered the larger and more beautiful world in which I've had so much richer a set of experiences than I'd ever have had. But with crime, you know, there's nobody who says, I'm really glad that my child ended up this way. There is no positive spin to put on it. It's a tragedy.
There is, on the other hand, a lot of positive spin over the people who had children as a result of rape, who learn extreme love, despite the nightmare of where it began.
And I was very compelled by those stories. I was interested in what the struggles were of the women who had had those children. I was interested in the ways that husbands or partners or other people helped them to arrive at acceptance. I was struck by how they struggled endlessly against some impulse toward revulsion. I mean, there was one woman who said to me, I look at my daughter and I know that she's innocent, but every time she comes to hug me, it's like 1,000 razor blades scraping across my skin. Ooh. And I remember as particularly striking, I went, in the first part of the book, I wanted to have one non-Western context, and I went to look at the experience of deaf people in a village in northern Bali, where there's been a heritage of deafness that's been handed down for several hundred years. And for the rape chapter, I went to Rwanda and interviewed women who had been raped in the genocide. And there was one of those women who I remember talking to. She was an unbelievably, ravishingly beautiful Tutsi woman. She had been through horrors beyond all describing during the genocide and had ended up with this child. She told me her whole story. And as she finished the story, I said to her, as I tend to say in interview situations, do you have any questions for me? Because I always feel it sort of balances the power dynamic of those conversations. And usually in Rwanda, people had said, will this be published in French? Are you going to use my real name? How long are you staying here? And this woman looked at me and she said, well, you're in this field of psychology, right? And I said, yes, more or less. And she said, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? She said, because I want to love her, but when I look at her, I see what happened to me and it gets in the way. And I was so taken aback that I sort of stepped backwards. And she said very insistently, can you tell me how to love my daughter more? And it was unfortunately only a few days later that I kept thinking and thinking about the conversation that I realized how much love there was in that question itself.
Yes, it's a totally loving question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it expresses all those doubts. No, that's very, it's very moving, that. Do you see now a lot more of the feminists now in England, for instance, they're campaigning much more now about the rights of transgender, which is now something that's becoming a much, much larger thing. Do you see that being accepted more in America?
It's astonishing how rapid the progress has been in the US and in the UK, and I think in some measure in other countries as well. They're really, when I started working on this book, I would mention to people that I was doing a chapter on children who were transgender, and people would say, on what? And they were kind of incredulous. And now, you know, Laverne Cox, who's a transgender actress, was on the cover of Time magazine. The visibility of transgender people has been huge. It was the chapter that was the most poignant in many ways for me, because I started off thinking that transgenderism was an interesting and rather obscure condition with which I had nothing in particular in common. I thought of it as being much like autism. It was very interesting for all kinds of reasons, but irrelevant to me. And as I worked with transgender people and talked about their stories, I realized how much of the prejudice I myself had encountered as a gay person had to do not with my sexuality, because most of it was around before I had any sexual life whatsoever, or even any thought of one. It had to do with the ways in which I varied in minor ways in choosing pink balloons from what was expected of boys. And so I ended up feeling a kind of sympathy with the people who were trans. And what I felt as I went along more and more was that gender norms have a long tradition, but they can be very hierarchical and they can be very, very oppressive. And that if you allow people the freedom to express whatever it is that they feel and whoever it is that they are, then you're actually creating a society which is a much more free and open society. And to some extent, the lesson of people who are trans is that some people actually want to live in a different gender. And some people, the opposite gender to the one they were assigned at birth. And some people actually want to linger somewhere in between. And many people just want a little bit of freedom. You know, if a little boy says, I want to do these things, and little boys don't want to do these things, so I must be transgender because they're not things that boys want to do. What he's showing evidence of is not of being transgender. He's showing evidence of sexism that's built into the society. If behavior that would be exemplary in a little girl is considered an illness and a defect in a little boy, that's a distinction that in this post-feminist era I think is very highly problematical. Now, that doesn't mean we have to give up on gender altogether. Most of us are quite attached to the gender that we have. But I think the openness to these possibilities makes an enormous difference. And I think more and more it's clear that there are a lot of people all along who have felt that they had to spend their whole lives acting a gender conformity that was not authentic to them. And some of them actually are transgender, and if we give them the liberty to express themselves as who they know themselves to be and believe themselves to be, then I think that we're actually creating a society of happier people who will lead more productive, better lives. I think it's better for all of us.
And do you think that actually what we're beginning to see is that this is much more common than we know? Because actually, things have been, in my lifetime in the UK, have gone from a point where homosexuality was punished by sending people to prison to Now we can celebrate gay marriage and the picture goes on the front of the Times. And it's an amazing transformation, but it does got that feeling that this is a much bigger thing somehow, that people have a bit of this and a bit of that. And we have all been very narrowly channeled.
I think we've all been typed a great deal. You know, you're typed as gay, or you're typed as straight, or maybe you're typed as bisexual, but that then becomes its own identity. There isn't a lot of room given for a shift in fluidity. Now, one of the big issues, and it's an issue I look at a lot in the book, is what to do with children who assert that they really are members of the other gender. And there was one person I interviewed who had been born male and who had a very strong sense of female identity, and she told me that she was absolutely, definitely a girl. And she also told me that when she grew up, she was 7, that when she grew up, she was planning to live in a treehouse and have rainbow-colored hair that fell all the way to the ground. And I thought, okay, you know, there's a lot of kind of complicated imagining that children go through. It's very, very difficult to ascertain clearly and definitively which children are actually going to go on to be transgender, which are going to go on to be only gay, and which actually are going through a phase from which they'll emerge. But I think we're making progress in being able to draw those distinctions. It was very dangerous when we insisted that a child who really believed that she could only be happy living as a girl nonetheless grow up as a boy and go through male puberty and develop facial hair and all of the other aspects of male puberty. It can also be dangerous if the second a child says, but sometimes I feel like I'm a girl, and you say, you must be trans, we'll bring you up as a girl then, and sort of make the shift too rapidly. And I feel as though there's now a kind of divided society in which some parts of society refuse to acknowledge this possibility and some parts of society run away too quickly with it. And we need to find a balance, and I think we're negotiating it now.
And in terms of families and family structures, have we moved on that as well in terms of accepting other models apart from mum, dad, and 2.2 children?
I think we have.
Andrew has a really interesting family structure, which we're coming around to. As a last question before we chuck it open to the audience,
So I will just say that the basic structure of my family is that my husband, who's here tonight, is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. One of my closest friends from college had got divorced but wanted to have a child, and so she and I decided to have one, and we have a daughter, and mother and daughter live in Texas. And then my husband and I wanted the experience of bringing up a child full-time in our household, and so we have our son, whom I mentioned before, of whom I am the biological father. We had an egg donor, and the surrogate who carried the pregnancy was Laura, the lesbian mother of his two biological children.
See? All possible.
So it ends up more or less being six parents of four children in three states.
Well, I think that they're really lucky kids, quite frankly. Can we put the house lights up and get some mics out? And please, we've got Andrew and I have got these things, so it can be in Spanish or English, your questions. Do we have these things? I can't see a thing, I'm afraid. Okay.
Wow.
I know. You see it now. Maybe we kept it. Okay. Who wants to start? I can't believe there's nobody here who doesn't want to ask a question. Oh. Hi. Oh, yeah. Some hands up there. Can we...
Hi, I wanted to ask you, Andrew, if you saw any parallels between depression and the horizontal issues you looked through in the book Far From the Tree. Did you see any comparisons to your prior book about depression?
Yes. My previous book, you've indicated, was about depression. It dealt in part with my own experience of depression and in part with an attempt to examine depression in very broad terms, culturally and socially and so on. People have asked me what the unifying theme is, and I don't think I knew as I started, but it became clear to me as I went along that I've always been interested in the mechanisms of resilience, in why it is that some people faced with these enormous difficulties are utterly defeated by them, and other people faced with comparable difficulties manage to rise to the occasion of them in one way or another. When I worked on the depression book, I found that there were many people who had what sounded, as they described it, like relatively minor depression, who were nonetheless utterly disabled by it and unable to do anything, and other people who had what sounded like more severe depression who were nonetheless able to have lives with some meaning, at least in the gaps between their depressive episodes. And as I looked at that, I realized that there was a very complicated interplay between illness and personality, that one of those things is not the same as the other, and that each of them in some ways feeds and affects the way that the other comes down. So that whole idea, why was it that some people could manage to do well, and could I explain those mechanisms of resilience in a way that would allow more people to access them when they were depressed? That was the goal, really, of the depression book, was in some ways also the goal of this book. It was to say, you have a child who is not what you had in mind, who is not what you wanted, who is not what you were counting on when you decided to have children. What is it that you can do to manage to make a meaningful experience out of that? Or to say to the children themselves, you have a condition you would not have elected, that you probably would not have wanted. Is there any way that you can go forward in it? And Far From the Tree deals with the idea that our differences in many ways, which feel so isolating when you consider them individually, the experience of negotiating difference is in fact something that most of humanity has in common. And if you think you have something in common only with other families dealing with schizophrenia, you're in a small world. And if you think you have something in common with people dealing with all of these challenges, you're in a very big and wide and encompassing one. And I think that was true for the people dealing with depression, and I think it's true for the families dealing with these identities.
I have a question. In all of these conversations that you had with people, particularly, for example, the people who had a child that had committed an atrocious crime, or a child that is really suffering, did any of the parents, and particularly the mothers, because it seems that those are the ones who appear in the news, express that they would have preferred for the child to die or to kill the child before it suffered more or caused suffering to other people?
I did have parents who said those very things. You know, I had a number of parents who said that. There was one father of a boy with schizophrenia who was describing to me the process in which he realized that his son had this condition and that his son was not going to function very well and was never going to reemerge. And as he was talking to me, he just broke down in tears and said, if he had only died, we would have been able to hold him in our hearts as who he was, and instead he's lived on into a life in which he achieves no joy for himself and brings no joy to anyone else, and I so wish that he had died instead. Now, it was a very difficult thing for a father to admit to and to say, but that was certainly what he said. After I finished the book, I did a profile of the family, the father mostly, of Adam Lanza, who committed the Newtown murders. I don't know how much exposure those had here in Colombia, but it was a boy who went in and killed a bunch of school children and in Connecticut 2 years ago. And Peter Lanza, I said to him, if you really could choose, I said, would you wish that he never existed? And Peter Lanza said, I would wish he had never existed. And even Sue Klebold, who said that she loved her child so much, said that when the whole thing was going on at the school and when they first had begun to understand the incomprehensible fact that their son was implicated, she said, I prayed that he would die before he hurt anyone else. She said, I prayed he would die. She said, and then I thought, if he's going to die, I hope he'll die from his own gun and not someone else's, so I'll know that it's what he wanted too. She said, and that's what happened. And you can't imagine what it's like to live your life knowing that you prayed for your child to commit suicide and he did it. She said, but of course, I wish he'd done it sooner before he hurt so many people.
Right. Gentleman here? Oh, here. Oh, and here. You? No, okay. Over there.
Hi. My name is Abdel Peña, and it has been an honor to actually meet you and hear about your work. It's for me, you're telling people about my story, how I have to learn to overcome a lot of prejudice about, you know, transgender people, and I'm a gay man, and I've been prejudiced about transgender people all my life, and now I have a wonderful partner who's here with me, and he has friends who are actually transgender, and I see it in the media now more often. And they're fabulous actors, and so are Down syndrome people. That girl in American Horror Story is superb. Do you think the media is really doing their part to overcome all these prejudices and bring us all together through tragedy, through other differences? Do you think the media is doing their part in doing so?
Well, the media is a very big mixed operation. So there are definitely parts of the media that are enforcing and sustaining traditions of extreme prejudice and that you know, lead people to have more benighted views. But I think overall, yes, I think the visibility of people has changed. There's an American woman who has a son with Down syndrome. Her name is Emily Pearl Kingsley, and she was a writer for Sesame Street and the children's television program. And she described lying in the hospital the day after her son was born, and she was told that he had DS. And she said, suddenly there was no one on the television who looked like me. And she went to the producers at Sesame Street, and she said, all of those scenes with the little children playing that are on that television all the time, I want you to put Jason in some of them. And so Jason was put on the television. He was the kid with Down syndrome on Sesame Street. And he was really the first person with that kind of condition who was widely viewed. And she wrote a lot about that experience and about how she sometimes wondered what the effect would be on Jason's self-image to have been so public. But she felt like the service that was being performed was so important. And in fact, Jason ended up being, I think, quite gratified to be reasonably famous. One of the people I worked with was someone who had for many years been in the disability community, and she described going out to lunch in Los Angeles with the actress who appeared on the television program Glee, the actress with Down syndrome, and she said, people were coming over and asking her for her autograph. She was a celebrity first and a person with a disability second. I never dreamed I would see such a moment. Now, I've dwelt on Down syndrome. You alluded to the person with Down syndrome in Horror Story in every one of the categories that I've written about. I think that there is a tendency toward greater understanding, and I think that there's a broader acceptance of the general notion that human diversity has value. That does not mean that human diversity is universally appreciated. It does not mean that these are easy lives. It does not mean that the media representations are consistently wonderful. But if you look at the television, if you look at the cinema, if you read the stories that are in newspapers, there are lives being reported on that were for hundreds of years essentially invisible. And I think that's the most spectacular progress of our time. Thank you.
Okay. We have time for one more question, I think, maybe two. Okay. We've got two hands. Okay. Where is the microphone?
Thank you very much for your time. My question has to do with immigration. There are about 6 million children, Hispanic children, are growing up without a father because the parents, families cannot be reunited. So my question is, what do you think, how are these children likely to grow, and how would you help them?
Sorry, children who are separated from
Where are they?
Many cases, the mother is in Mexico, she gets pregnant, the father goes to work in America, he never comes back.
I think this is a devastating reality, and there are actually some people I'm very close to who are working in America and who haven't been able to see their two daughters now in 10 years. They Skype, they're in contact, but they haven't been able to meet each other. I cannot see how it is serving the interests of any economy or of any system to divide families in that way. I think it's a bizarre and terrible event. I think there probably have to be ways in which immigration laws are conceived and overseen, but I think in a society in which there are clearly an enormous number of illegal immigrants who are tolerated because they take up the jobs that most of the legal residents don't want to have those people forcibly separated from their own children, from their wives, from the lives that they had through financial necessity, I think is one of the great evils of our time. There are some families who manage it very well. I think it's possible for children to grow up with a single parent and be extremely well parented. I don't know that every child requires two parents. I think sometimes two parents don't do such a great job. I think sometimes a single parent, often a mother, does quite a remarkable job. So I think that there are stories here which have some, in which it's all working out as well as it can under the circumstances. But it's a hideous cruelty, and if I had the power to change that law, especially as it exists in the United States, where there are so many illegal immigrants separated from their families, it would be my top priority.
Okay, I'm afraid now we have to come to an end. Andrew's book's on sale outside. Will you join me in giving him a very, very big thank you?
Thank you.